Welcome to Learning in a Minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Novak. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Brian Lynn has a story on environmental restoration projects in Jordan. Ana Mateo brings us words and their stories on the expression hit the nail on the head. Dan Friedel and Jill Robbins have this week's Higher Education Report on Harvard's historical connection to slavery. John Russell reports on a disease killing horses. And Jill Robbins returns for a story on the debate over the French language in Canada. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
New projects in the Middle Eastern country of Jordan aim to repair damaged land in one of the world's most water-starved nations. The restoration measures include bringing native plants back to areas where they disappeared, as well as building modern water collection systems. Local organizations believe the projects will help lessen the effects of land mismanagement and climate change. The efforts seek to slow expanding desertification, which happens when land turns into desert. A United Nations report released April 26th states that 40% of land worldwide is currently degraded. The report by the UN's Convention to Combat Desertification predicts that by 2030, 700 million people could be displaced by drought. It blames the problems on land and water mismanagement, poor agriculture methods, mining, and city development. Jordan is one of several countries already struggling with the effects of degradation, the report said. But environmentalists in Jordan are already taking steps to prevent further land damage. One of the efforts is introducing 4 native plants to 41 square kilometers of desert in the Sabha area, about 90 kilometers east of Jordan's capital, Amman. "We're working on the water, we're working on the green cover, and we're working also with the habitats of the creatures, from insects to animals," said Dayala Tarana. She helped create WADI, an organization seeking to repair forests and grasslands and find ways to improve water security in Jordan. The success rate of these plants is 85%, which is considered a very high percentage, Tarana said. And they only need to be watered once, which is also reducing the amount of water needed for the irrigation of the green areas. But as WADI's efforts continue, environmentalists say land restoration in Jordan still faces major difficulties. One of them is a lack of land areas available for restoration. In addition, many people in local communities are not willing to leave the land alone for at least 1 or 2 rainy seasons to let it recover. The UN report calls for financial support to strengthen restoration efforts in developing countries. Among other things, it urges the expansion of protected and conservation areas, better water management, and improved agricultural methods. If such measures are carried out, they can lead to reduced biodiversity loss and improved soil health, the report says. The efforts could especially help areas in North and Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. But the report also notes that a lack of action could result in up to 16 million square kilometers of land degradation by 2050. That is an area about the size of South America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore the meaning of words and expressions in the English language. Today, we talk about a saying that comes from the world of carpentry. Two of the most basic tools for building things are a hammer and nail. With them, you can build many wooden structures, from a house to a piece of furniture to a picture frame. For the nail to go into the wood, you must hit the nail on the flat part at the very top. This is called the head. If you miss, you might damage the wood or injure yourself. So our expression for today is to hit the nail on the head. We use it several ways. When you hit the nail on the head, you got something exactly right. In other words, you were correct. Here is an example.
Hey, remember when you told me that Bob would not last long at his new job?
Yeah, that was last week. I got the feeling from him that he was not enjoying the work.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. He just texted me that he quit his job.
Hitting the nail on the head can also mean you have understood or expressed something perfectly. For example, you could say that the reporter hit the nail on the head in her explanation of current budget debates in the city. If you have hit the nail on the head, you have also described a situation accurately. That situation can be either good or bad. Here is another example.
How was your camping trip?
It was amazing. I haven't had that much fun outdoors in forever.
Wonderful. Didn't Stacy suggest the campground you visited?
Yes. She said it was heaven, with lots of outdoor activities, and she really hit the nail on the head. We stayed for 4 days and loved every minute.
So if you are totally right about something, if you describe something perfectly, if you find the exact answer, or if you do or say the right thing, You have hit the nail on the head. Word experts claim that by the time Henry David Thoreau used the expression in 1849, it was already a commonly used one. In A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, he wrote this.
The poet will prevail to be popular in spite of his faults, and in spite of his beauties, too. He will hit the nail on the head, and we shall not know the shape of his hammer. He makes us free of his hearth and heart, which is greater than to offer one the freedom of a city.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Harvard University recently offered details of its historical connection to slavery and announced a $100 million fund aimed at studying and dealing with those links. The findings were released on April 26th in a 130-page report. The university began publicly speaking about its connections to slavery in 2016. That year, the university placed a sign on its campus honoring four enslaved people who worked for two different Harvard presidents in the 1700s. Harvard's president, Lawrence Bacow, started the current investigation into the university's links to slavery in 2019. The group of investigators included professors who looked into the names and stories of people who worked for no pay. The committee found that the university and its leaders, including four of the school's presidents, enslaved people. The new report, the writers said, adds to work started in 2007 by Harvard professors and students to show the university's connection to slavery. Harvard is the oldest university in the United States. It opened in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1636, when the area was still a colony of Britain. At the time, putting people to work for no pay was permitted. The report notes that slavery was common around the world and was an important part of the economy in the northeastern colonies, and powerfully shaped Harvard University. For example, some people who gave money to Harvard in its early history became rich by buying and selling slaves. The report's writers said Harvard is now part of the long and growing list of American universities entangled with the history of slavery.
Enslaved people worked at the university for almost 150 years, until slavery became illegal in Massachusetts in 1783. The school's report said at least 70 Black people and Native Americans were enslaved. That included people who worked on the university land and in the homes of the school's leaders. In addition, the university, which is the richest in the U.S., gained wealth by investing in industries such as cotton and sugarcane, which used forced labor. Those crops were grown by enslaved people in the American South and the Caribbean islands. Many buildings at Harvard are named for people who owned other people. The report notes that Harvard has profited from the idea that slavery in the United States was centered in the American South. In fact, the report says, the economy in the northeastern colonies thrived because of their connection to slavery and businesses that used forced labor. Researchers said there were likely more than 70 enslaved people, but they only found 70 names. They added that some of the enslaved people were Native Americans. Many of the enslaved people were known only by their first names, which included Cesar, Dinah, Delia, Renty, and Venus.
Bacow announced the $100 million fund to deal with what he called the corrosive effects of slavery on individuals, on Harvard, and on our society. The money will be used to make up for the mistreatment of the people who worked for the university, but it will not be paid directly to the living family members of Harvard's slaves. The report said the university should permit some students at historically black colleges and universities to study at Harvard for 1 year at a time. It also said the school should make education more available for the descendants of slaves in the southern U.S. and the Caribbean area. In addition, the writers said Harvard should offer educational programs to members of Native American tribes in the northeastern U.S. The report said that even after slavery became illegal, some of the university's professors taught racial theories about why white people were better than black people. Some professors did studies on race that researchers have connected to policies of the leaders of Nazi Germany. The report called some of this work, which included photographing black people without clothing and measuring their bodies, abusive. Bacow called the findings disturbing and shocking, and said the ideas permitted deeply immoral activities. In more modern times, the report noted, the university was slow to make education and work available to black people. Between the 1890s and 1940s, only about 3 black men per year attended the university. By 1960, the number had only grown to 9 in the first year class.
The report said the university should spend money to make up for the past, but did not clearly say the school should give money to the descendants of the enslaved people who worked at Harvard. Payments to make up for bad treatment in the past are sometimes called reparations. Harvard instead said it will make up for its wrongs through teaching, research, and service. Other universities are doing similar things. At Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., the school is trying to raise $400,000 per year to give to the descendants of the enslaved people sold by the school. At Princeton University in New Jersey, the School of Religion started a $27 million fund to make up for enslaving people. And the University of Virginia, founded by U.S. President Thomas Jefferson, created scholarships for the living family members of those it enslaved. However, some critics say those universities should do more, or that they are not following through on their promises. Now that Harvard has released its report, education leaders will want to see how the $100 million is spent and whether it makes a difference.
In the report, Bacow noted that Harvard is far from perfect, but it always tries to be better. The university president said Harvard is committed to following the recommendations and embracing the challenges before us. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
U.S. government officials say an unknown and fast-spreading disease has killed 85 wild horses in less than 1 week in the western state of Colorado. Federal officials made the announcement Wednesday. The number of deaths at a federal corral, or holding area for horses, increased from an earlier announcement of 67. Stephen Hall of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, BLM, told Reuters the facility is under quarantine. That means animals are not permitted to enter or leave the area. More than 2,500 animals are held at the facility in Canyon City, 190 kilometers southwest of Denver. Animals that are sick or have been exposed to infected horses are being kept away from the healthy ones. A BLM statement earlier this week said, "Wild horses at the Wild Horse Facility in Canyon City have been infected with an unknown yet highly contagious and sometimes fatal disease." Fatal is a term that means deadly. Most of the sickened horses had been transported from Rio Blanco County, near the neighboring state of Utah. Officials collected the animals last autumn, the BLM said. Hall said the dead animals are being examined. Blood and tissue samples are being carefully studied at two university laboratories. The main symptoms seem to be respiratory issues and chest congestion, Hall said, adding that federal, state, and independent veterinarians are investigating the issue. Horses are not native to the United States. Their ancestors were animals freed or left by people during the settlement of the American West. The BLM said the horses must be controlled because the animals damage water supplies and eat food that native species eat. There are an estimated 80,000 wild horses in the U.S. The agency collects some of the wild animals in events called roundups. BLM transports the animals to holding areas where some are sold. Activists say the roundups and living conditions for the animals are inhumane. Suzanne Roy of the American Wild Horse Campaign said in a statement posted on the group's website, "Disease outbreaks and deaths are the direct result of the BLM's mass roundups." Roy added, "We can expect to see more suffering and death if BLM continues down this dangerous and destructive path." I'm John Russell. Thank you.
Canada has two official languages, English and French. But recent events in Canada have caused a new debate over whether French speakers face discrimination. Canada's largest railway company, CN, is based in Montreal. The city is in the province of Quebec, where 95% of the population speaks French. However, none of CN's recently named nominees for its corporate board are native French speakers. After public anger, the company said it plans to search for a French-speaking board member in the coming months. The question of whether Canadian business leaders should be bilingual in French and English began receiving attention last November. The attention came after comments made by Air Canada President Michel Rousseau. Rousseau said he did not have the time to learn French. The airline leader later publicly apologized for what he said. Canadian law requires state-owned companies like CN and Air Canada to provide services in both English and French. The same is true for places like airports and government ministries. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is bilingual. He said this week he was concerned about the lack of French speakers on CN's board. French-speaking Canadians across the country should see themselves reflected in our major national institutions, Trudeau said. Of Canada's 37 million people, only 8 million speak French. The Canadian Constitution in 1982 officially protected the French language as an official language. But the recent happenings have reminded people of the continued fight to support the language. A recent public opinion study found that over 90% of Canadians support bilingualism as part of Canada's culture. However, only 20% of the population can speak both French and English. Stéphane Bolloc is a law professor and co-director of the University of Montreal's National Observatory of Linguistic Rights. He said that, in the past, supporting the use of French meant to be in favor of the separation of Quebec from Canada. Quebec is a mostly French-speaking province in Canada. Things have changed today, Bolloc said, so people are more daring to challenge the domination of English. Some Canadians criticized Trudeau's decision last year to not choose a French speaker as Canada's Governor General. The position serves as Queen Elizabeth II's official representative in the country. Instead, Trudeau appointed an Indigenous Canadian, Mary Simon, to the position. She is from Nunavik in northern Quebec. She speaks English and an Inuit language, but not French. This Prime Minister's office also recently faced criticism from the Canadian Commissioner of Official Languages. The criticism came because the Prime Minister's office does not have French subtitles in all videos on their social media page. Stephanie Chouinard is a political science professor at the Royal Military College of Canada. She said, "Everyone must be able to be served in their preferred language, since few Canadians are truly bilingual." I'm Jill Robbins.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Dan Novak.